Welcome to a Tuesday edition of Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. A memorial service is being planned for Jefferson Thomas, who is one of the nine black students who integrated Little Rock's Central High School. He died this weekend in Columbus, Ohio, at the age of 67. Michael Hiblin with KUAR in Little Rock has reaction.
Inside the National Park Visitor Center, surrounded by displays showing the Little Rock Nine and what happened in 1957, Minnie Jean Brown Trickey struggled with her emotions.
There's a great deal of sadness because our, what do we call ourselves now?
Jefferson Thomas has become the first of the Little Rock Nine to die. He had been suffering from pancreatic cancer. 53 years ago this month, they were part of the group that braved angry white mobs to attend Central. Trickey says Thomas's humor was key in their survival.
I've been looking at photos of us coming out of the school, and we're always laughing, coming out of terror, and we're laughing. And that is in part because we had comedians, and Jeff was among the best. He had a very wry, self-effacing humor that helped us live. I know that people want to say we're brave and courageous, but sometimes somebody being funny was really important, and Jeff was really funny, and he's continued that until the moment of his death, no doubt.
Speaking in Little Rock in 2004, Jefferson Thomas said he struggled to keep from getting angry because he didn't want to end up in fights with other students.
It had to be a mindset, and I later on at Central learned to laugh and kind of make jokes about it when the guys were kicking and tripping and trying to, you know, hit me. And most of the time they missed, you know, because I just had the mindset that I wasn't going to get angry and forget about why I was here. I tried to, you know, keep in mind, don't let them make you angry.
UALR history professor and associate dean of the graduate school, Johanna Miller Lewis, eventually became friends with Thomas.
He was very quiet, self-effacing, had a great sense of humor, liked to tell jokes on himself and stories about himself. But he was sort of quiet, and he had suffered for that during the crisis. He got bullied on a lot, but he followed his rules, which were to not react and you know, not do anything. And I think that ate away at him a little bit later in life.
After Central, Thomas went to college and joined the military, serving as an infantry squad leader during the Vietnam War. He eventually moved to Columbus, Ohio, spending 27 years working as a civil servant for the Defense, Finance, and Accounting Services. Another of the Little Rock Nine, Terrence Roberts, tells KUAR that he wasn't surprised to learn of Thomas's death.
This was not entirely unexpected, since we all knew, that is, a group of us and a group of nine knew that Jeff had been experiencing some rather serious health problems for a few years now. And I had just learned that he had been hospitalized a few days before I learned that he had died. And it's a sad loss, for sure, especially because, you know, we're such a small group. And with one of us passing away, we have shrunk down even more.
The last time all nine were able to get back together was in November.
Beautiful. Amazing.
When they reunited for a photo shoot outside the school by The New Yorker. As word spread Monday of Thomas's death, many people began stopping by the National Park Visitor Center across from the school.
We were visiting here in Little Rock, and we wanted to come by and see the site where all of this happened.
Elisa Jenkins and her husband are from Dallas and made their first trip to Central.
Kind of unreal. It's hard to imagine just to be able to go to school, which we all think now is a basic right, but soldiers have to get you into school. It's just unreal. It's just unreal. And it's just amazing to see how far we've come, you know, in such a short period of time, but still how far we need to go.
Jefferson Thomas was 67 years old. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Michael Hiplin in Little Rock.
This is Ozarks at Large. Fayetteville teen Serena Caffrey is an independent social entrepreneur, and her passion is green cooking. This Saturday at Nibbles Academy, she'll teach young people how to prepare easy meals from scratch with fresh, locally grown food. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich takes us into her kitchen.
Serena Caffrey slices pale yellow squash in her family's kitchen this afternoon, preparing a tasty after-school nosh.
All right, so what I'm making is squash dimes, or you can call them gold dollars or something like that. We're going to saute them and make a sandwich out of them with brie.
So these are going to be small, round, veggie cheese sandwiches, no bread. Serena places the squash chunks not into a plastic microwave oven, but rather a skillet filled with sizzling golden butter. Serena hums to herself as she hunts for more ingredients in the fridge. She's a trained singer, ballet dancer, straight-A student, and unlike many of her self-consumed peers, a dedicated activist. And by the way, she's 14 years old, about to turn 15.
And so we have these circles of squash that we're now sauteing with butter on medium heat. And I've cut them relatively thin so that they'll brown, and I don't want to crowd them on the skillet, and that way they will brown more quickly, which is part of the plan.
Serena Caffrey's middle name, Rose, perfectly suits. She's blossoming with beauty and altruism. She served as a peer helper at her junior high school, fundraises for the arts, and even spearheaded a Hurricane Katrina relief benefit when she was in elementary school. Speaking of kids, don't most of them hate squash?
Well, not necessarily. You see, I think, I believe strongly in this system called the Taster's Club. And this was a principle introduced to me as a young kid by my parents. And the Taster's Club functions as follows. You must taste everything. And that way, you get exposed to things that if you weren't forced to taste, you would never try.
Her interest in cooking peaked when she began working at the Fayetteville Farmers Market.
And just being surrounded by the produce, I started to experiment with it at home, and I realized my love for it and my passion for it and how good these fresh foods tasted, and that's what got my mind tinkering on this idea of green food solutions.
Serena's new business sounds a bit industrial, but her idea, Green Foods Solutions, emerges from an organizational paradigm called Summer of Solutions. These are gatherings of young people held around the country in places like Asheville, North Carolina, Austin, Texas, Corvallis, Oregon, and Fayetteville, Arkansas. It's where she learned the term independent social entrepreneur.
A social entrepreneur is someone who goes out into the community and pursues a business idea or plan, but one that empowers social classes, especially those that are disadvantaged, and also is environmentally aware. And furthermore, the most important part of social entrepreneurism is someone who doesn't always seek value in money.
The Summer of Solutions program was dreamed up by Grand Aspirations. That's operated by a group of McAllister College students in St. Paul, Minnesota. It mixes young people, government, and business leaders together to collaborate on innovative, self-sustaining, and interdependent initiatives that systematically integrate climate and energy solutions, economic security, and social justice. Because eating locally grown foods, preferably organic, is ecological, uses less energy, fewer chemical pesticides, and supports local economies, Serena's decided to teach these principles to children at Nibbles Academy Cooking School in Fayetteville, operated by Chef Susie Stevens.
Firstly, and my favorite, we'll be making a semolina pasta dough. And people get frightened by the idea of making pasta because it seems like such a foreign, packaged, hardened object that we eat every now and then. But really, it's so easy. So few ingredients, it only takes a few minutes to knead the dough. And really, the only long part about this process is letting the dough sit for an hour before we cook it. But it's a 2-hour class, so we'll have the time. And also, we've been making a pizza dough, and the kids can build their own pizzas depending on ingredients that they like. But we're, of course, going to encourage them to try new things. And then we're going to be making a simple salad out of vegetables that are abundant at the time.
the pasta sauce, she says, will of course be locally grown fresh tomatoes, not canned. Serena says she observes her peers' preferences for fast food loaded with fat, salt, carbs, and sugar, and notices the effect.
The food that they're eating leaves them lethargic and tired, and they want to sleep, and they want to get out of class, and they're under fluorescent lights, and their teacher may be droning on, and they just don't have the drive to pick themselves up after lunch and say, okay, I'm ready for the next part of my day. And even after breakfast, if they don't eat a good breakfast, I don't eat a good breakfast. I'm not trying to exclude myself. But it's hard to grasp all that you can in school when you don't put effort into your diet and you're not aware of what you're eating.
Still, Serena is old school.
I went through a phase where I would read Mastering the Art of French Cooking by Julia Childs in bed every night. And I would make the custard again and again and again, and I could never get it right. I still can't get it right, but I kept on trying. So yes, I read cookbooks. I also have an amazing cookbook from the owner of Verbena Restaurant in New York. She's a botanist and cook, and her dishes are so interesting and fascinating. So yes, I love reading cookbooks, but I don't actually cook from cookbooks that much. I just read them to get ideas, but usually I just like to cook my own recipes. And as far as cooking shows go, I don't watch that much TV, and so I don't tend to watch them as much, but love me some Rachel Ray every now and then.
As she talks, she slices brie to finish up her squash sandwiches.
And what I'm going to do is put a half slice of brie between each of these squash dollars, or whatever you want to call them, these coins. And I've turned the heat down to very low now that the squash has been browned. And I'm just going to let the cheese melt for a minute. And I'm going to sprinkle just a little bit of black pepper on top, some freshly ground black pepper. And we're going to stack them on top of each other so that they make these little towers of squash sandwiches. And it becomes this delicious gourmet-ish recipe. And it's relatively easy and very quick. I'm putting on my black pepper right now. And voila!
Teen Serena Caffrey will share her enthusiasm and skills at her Green Foods Solutions cooking class for kids, September 11th from noon to 2, at Nibbles Academy in Fayetteville, supervised by Chef Susie Stevens. Reporting for Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
If you're interested in reserving a spot at Serena Caffrey's cooking class for children, call Nibbles Academy. Their phone number, 966-4499. And for details, you can visit Serena's blog at paperyear.blogspot.com. That's paperyear.blogspot.com. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Inside the Fine Arts Center Gallery on the University of Arkansas campus this month are nine paintings created by native Arkansan Terry Rowlett. The large works are influenced by his time growing up in and around Green Forest. But the oil on canvas paintings also owe a great deal to the Hudson River area of New York, where he spends part of his time now. Playful, yet sometimes just a bit foreboding, paintings in the exhibit, At the Edge of Eden, do not let your eyes move away quickly. And people who spend more time examining the works are rewarded. Small details emerge. Birds, or an almost obscured skeleton, tell just a bit more of the story. Last week, Terry Rowlett met me at the Fine Arts Center Gallery on the U of A campus and gave me a tour of the nine works selected for the exhibit. He says his early exposure to the evangelical South continues to flex some influence on his work as well.
Definitely did grow up in it, and it's kind of probably going to be, well, it will be with me for the rest of my life, even though I've evolved spiritually away from it. It's still, you know, turning all the screws, you know, the awareness and whatnot.
When you say you grew up in it, the stories of the Bible, things like that?
Every Sunday was, you know, very much the old 1960s early version of evangelicalism, and lots of Bible study, lots of fear and brimstone and all that, yes.
The stories, especially the stories in the Old Testament, I grew up in rural Arkansas too, are ripe for visual depiction.
Yeah. definitely the stories are visually rich and frightful and big and profound. And of course, there are the illustrated Bibles that probably were some of the first things I looked at. And I'm probably not too far off in that kind of format now with the look of my paintings.
A youth spent in the Arkansas Ozarks, a master's earned at the University of Georgia, and time spent in Italy studying the old masters all combines in Terry Rallett's portraits, like that of a hunter, long dead, propped against a tree in the forest. This painting, it's a skeleton decked out in bright colors, still gripping its rifle, is titled Hunter's Lament.
I really like this one. This one's brand new. I've got these two paintings here with people with rifles out in the woods. But this is definitely a hunter who has gone out into the woods and has probably died a year ago. And he's still clothed in his denim Levi pants, his hunting boots, and his nice wool red shirt. But he has turned into a skeleton. So it's kind of horrific, ghoulish, and funny at the same time when you look at this guy leaning against the tree with this almost ecstasy jaw, smile, smirk on his face. But just kind of making a statement about without mankind, maybe nature would do much better, because you have all these, I've got birds, I've got a mouse, I've got crows and deer, and they're all happily walking around and having a good life out there without the fear of the Bushnell scope taking them out.
Crow has a bullet in its mouth.
Right.
It's picked it up.
Right. I kind of put that little hat in there. To me, this cheerful or sad hunter looks almost like a beggar. He's got his hat out in front. Or he could also be a holy man in the yoga position, mm-hmm. an enlightened being at last. So the figure is symbolic of enlightenment or humility with the hat out front. And I thought it would be nice to have the crow paying unto Caesar, paying unto the hunter what is rightly his. And he's been gathering up shell casings throughout the woods, different calibers of gun. And he's stacking them slow, you know, methodically in the hat of the hunter as his payment. Just a strange little twist to put in there.
Terry Rallett uses friends and acquaintances as models. His friend Jane is in two of the paintings in the exhibit. Close inspection of his work reveals Rallett's detail for the human body, bones and flesh that look ready to move off the canvas and touch you.
They do take a long time, and since they are pretty realistic looking images of real people that I generally know that I get to have as models, I don't need to insult them by making them too different than what they really look like. So I know when something's not right, and a lot of people that know anatomy and know good art would see a mistake. And it's embarrassing to send something out with a slight, lesser degree of finish in the hands or in the eyes or something. So they take a long time. I probably paint about 7 to 10 paintings a year. So it's a pretty slow process.
The works that are here in the gallery are large. Do you work standing up, looking at them, then back up to see what you have?
A lot of that. Sometimes a lot of sitting down. I have chairs on wheels. I have easels that move the pictures up and down. Without a doubt, you might work 30 minutes or an hour. Then you have to step way back. You have to take lunch breaks. You have to come back into the room and look at them. And it's just a real slow process of getting everything in harmony. Having a more objective eye by turning it upside down, leaving it for a week. And I constantly look at the paintings while I'm working on them in a mirror. So you get a whole different, more objective look of the painting. And that will really startle me often with glaring mistakes when you look at something in the mirror. So if it works in the mirror, it's going to work with my own set of eyes and my own brain looking at it head on without a mirror.
And you mentioned upside down. You turn it upside down?
Yeah. You often do that for compositional reasons. You'll see where maybe you've weighted a picture a little too heavy in one corner or top or bottom. And by turning it upside down, you realize what you need to do to spread out the balance of the painting.
I doubt I'll ever see one of your paintings upside down.
No.
I probably won't see one in a mirror. So if I don't see them like that,
right.
Why do you go to that effort?
You don't need to see them that way because I've suffered the process for you. And if I hadn't have done that, you would probably come in here and maybe see, feel a little uncomfort with the success of the pictures. You know, there just might be something a little imbalanced for you. And I think I have balanced them. I guess it would almost be like balancing a tire on a car or something. I'm sure it's a weird technique, but you know, you want them to be balanced, and the person who drives the car wants it to be balanced. The viewer needs these to be balanced.
Even if we don't consciously know that.
Exactly. Yeah, you wouldn't know that.
Terry Rowlett's painting, King of the Swimming Hole, will probably strike a chord with anybody who did grow up on the lakes and rivers of the Ozarks. Two young men are near the water. A young woman is swimming nearby. A keg sits in the background. But, as is the case with his other paintings, there is much more going on at this riverbank.
I grew up in this early 70s, and I think ever since I was a child, swimming in the local bluff-edged creeks here, that there was always the older boys and gals that were drinking beer and having a good time right beside the kids. So this is a fond memory, and it's still a lifestyle of mine. I love swimming out in the creeks. And probably started this one last year, finished it, I think, this year. But there's just some kind of majesty about these people out here swimming that almost beckons to, King Arthur or
mythology.
Mythology, totally. Bacchus and a king and a queen and the hounds. And I just threw it in the keg of beer. I like to contemporize my images and kind of show us today where we kind of fit in the whole historical, you know, pantheon of people.
Well, now this almost feels also, though, like a stage, because are those curtains on either side of the top?
Two big red drapes on each side. So it has kind of that fun feel of a window or a stage setting of a play. And I think the swinging rope almost feels like it's part of the theater where you would lower and raise the curtain. But these guys are obviously going to swing out. I don't think the curtains are there for them to see, but they're there for the viewer to see. It's called King of the Swimming Hole, and I have these two men, one sitting down, one standing up, and it's kind of a debate in my mind, and I hope it's a debate in the viewer's mind, which one of the guys is the king at this point of the swimming hole. And a little mystery. Which one do you think it is?
It's the fellow sitting, the more solemn. Yeah. I mean, this guy reminds me of like Puck from Midsummer Night's Dream or something.
Yes. Yeah. I think you got it right, but probably the king on the rock sitting down will probably one day relinquish his rock to Puck, and he will be the king.
And if people want to know more and see other images, they can go to your website.
They can go to my website, terryrowlett.com, and that's TerryRowlett.com, and they can probably look at about 100 more paintings and see what they look like.
Terry, thanks for your time.
Thanks for the interview, and I'm glad to be back. I'm going to be in the Ozarks for the next month and doing a little canoeing maybe if it rains and some swimming.
Terry Rowlett's exhibit, At the Edge of Eden, can be viewed in the Fine Arts Center Gallery on the University of Arkansas campus through October 1st. A gallery talk and reception for the artists will take place Thursday, September 23rd, beginning at 5 p.m. at the gallery. To hear Terry Rowlett discuss the other works in the exhibit, you can go to our website, ozarksatlarge.com. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks at Large, Roby Brock of Talk Business looks back at the week that was in Arkansas business. Eureka Springs looks back to a bank robbery in the middle of town 88 years ago. And Joe Neal looks ahead toward the fate of the trumpeter swan in the Arkansas Ozarks and along the Arkansas River. That's all ahead. Plus, Garrison Keillor and the Writer's Almanac on this edition of Ozarks at Large. Later this week, the Association of Fundraising Professionals Northwest Arkansas Chapter will host the AFP Summit. That takes place on Thursday at the Jones Center for Families in Springdale. It's an educational networking event designed specifically for this region's nonprofit fundraising community and will include speakers on fundraising practices and ethics. For costs, to register or for more information, 582-4602. North of us, Lee and Grant, a traveling exhibition, is now on display at the Powers Museum of Carthage, Missouri. It will remain on display through October 20th. It offers a look at the lives, careers, and historical impact of Civil War generals Robert E. Lee and Ulysses S. Grant. For more information, powersmuseum.com. And the Arkansas chapter of the Trail of Tears Association will host We Remember, an afternoon of free programs Saturday afternoon from 1 until 3:15 at the Fayetteville Town Center. Events include a screening of a short documentary, a performance by the Cherokee National Youth Choir, a bike ride, and more. For more information on this free event, 751-7125. And this is Ozarks at Large.
Singer-songwriter Buddy Holly was born Charles Hardin Holly in Lubbock, Texas, on this date in 1936. Holly was the youngest of four children in a family of devout Baptists, and gospel music was an important part of his life from an early age. A good student with infectious personal charm, Holly was declared king of the sixth grade by his classmates. He became seriously interested in music at about 12 and pursued it with remarkable natural ability. Already well-versed in country music, bluegrass, and gospel, and a seasoned performer by 16, Holly became devoted to rhythm and blues. By 1955, after hearing Elvis Presley, Holly was a full-time rock and roller. Later that year, he bought an electric guitar and developed a style of playing featuring ringing major chords that became his trademark. In 1956, he signed with Decca Records' Nashville, Tennessee division, but the records he made for them sold poorly and were uneven in quality. In 1957, Holly and his new group, The Crickets, began their association with independent producer Norman Petty at his studio in Clovis, New Mexico. While crafting tracks such as Not Fade Away, Peggy Sue, Listen to Me, and Every Day, Holly and the Crickets camped out at Petty's studio for days at a time, using it as a combination laboratory and playground. They were the first rock and rollers to approach the recording process in this manner. The Crickets' first single, That'll Be the Day, was released in 1957, and it became an international multi-million seller. Soon after, Holly became a star and an icon. By 1959, the hit records tapered off, and Holly was living in New York with his new bride. He was estranged from the Crickets and broke. Holly participated in the doomed Winter Dance Party of 1959 tour through the frozen Midwest, during which he and co-headliners Richie Valens and the Big Bopper were killed in a plane crash. In 1986, Holly was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and in 1996, he was honored by the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences with a Lifetime Achievement Award. Little Rock native Ben Piazza died of cancer on this date in 1991. Piazza was an actor, director, author, and playwright who starred in such notable films as The Hanging Tree and Tell Me That You Love Me, Junie Moon. He was compared to the young Marlon Brando in his youth, but achieved acclaim for character roles in his later years, often portraying an edgy, tightly controlled suburbanite or a repressive parent in films such as The Blues Brothers.
This is the famous Dr. Philo T. Farnsworth, who invented electronic television.
In July of 1957, Philo T. Farnsworth appeared on the television show I've Got a Secret. The secret contestants failed to guess was that Farnsworth invented electronic television. On this date in 1927, the TV pioneer succeeded in transmitting an image through purely electronic means by using a device called an image dissector. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And sir, how old were you when you invented television, or the first television machine as we know it today, first television system?
I was 14.
14 years old.
It's Tuesday, September 7th. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me is Becca Bacon-Martin from What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
And today's short but important. Efren White, who's been everywhere lately, who has art at Ozark Folkways, is also performing tonight as part of the Sequoia Songwriters in the Round concert series at Mount Sequoia in Fayetteville. He plays at 7 o'clock in Parker Hall, and it is
free.
That's all I got.
Hey, that's plenty. Becca Bacon-Martin is entertainment editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
I'm Roby Brock with your Talk Business Update. A look back at the biggest business and political headlines of the last week. Arkansas tax revenues rose almost 6% compared to last year, with consumer spending boosting the August revenue report from the Arkansas Department of Finance and Administration. Year to date, that includes July and August numbers, gross revenues are up 5.7% above the same period 1 year ago and up 3.1% over forecast. DF&A officials said the improvement in revenue comes from the individual income taxes and gross receipts taxes, primarily through sales and use tax. Those two taxes account for 87% of total collections. Caterpillar officially opened its new $140 million motor grader plant in North Little Rock on Wednesday. The company, which is the world's largest maker of mining and construction equipment, announced in early 2009 it would bring the plant to Arkansas and hire up to 600 workers. Already 200 employees have been hired and trained and are making those new motor graders. Second quarter earnings for Arkansas banks jumped 25% from the previous year, according to the FDIC's quarterly banking profile. For the period ended June 30th, the report showed that Arkansas banks earned $210 million compared to $168 million a year ago. When compared to the previous quarter, profits at FDIC-insured Arkansas banks and savings and loans were up 76%. Now, despite the improvement, earnings do remain below historical norms. For example, Arkansas's FDIC-insured banks earned $262 million in the second quarter of 2007 compared to this year's $210 million. J.B. Hunt Transport Services awarded a $5 million gift to Arkansas Children's Hospital in Little Rock. The gift is designated specifically for the second floor of the hospital's new south wing, which began construction in 2008 and is scheduled for completion in the summer of 2012. The south wing will create an additional 54 inpatient beds. Delta Group Electronics, which assembles custom wiring harnesses and printed circuit boards, announced it's begun construction of a new 36,000 square foot building in Fayetteville. The expansion is expected to provide 75 new jobs to the area over the next several years. Finally, the Arkansas Realtors Association amended its June 2010 housing report after discrepancies surfaced in an initial report distributed 2 weeks ago. The revised housing report shows that home sales rose 3.3% in June of 2010 versus 2009. Valuations, the total cost of those homes sold, were higher at 2%. Statewide home prices, however, fell 1.2% for the month. Now, year-to-date, home sales are 12.5% higher in terms of units sold. The value of homes sold is up almost 11% for the January to June period compared to last year's six-month time frame, but that number may decline as future home sales are expected to slow with the expiration of federal tax credits. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business Update.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Friday, I'll participate in the next face-to-face debate between the major party candidates for Arkansas's U.S. Senate seat, Democrat incumbent Blanche Lincoln and Republican Congressman John Bozeman. They'll share the stage at the Peabody Hotel in downtown Little Rock. The four panelists, one of us from each of the state's congressional districts, will be able to ask two questions to the candidates. The candidates will ask each other questions during the second half of Friday's debate. There are few other debates scheduled between the candidates before the November election, so few chances to ask them questions. So, with that in mind, I'm soliciting any questions you might want asked of the person who will represent you in Washington, D.C. the next 6 years. The format of the debate will allow the panelists to ask a particular question to both of the candidates. If you have a question, just send an email by going to our website, ozarksatlarge.com. The other panelists participating in Friday's debate are Ray Ockert, the editor of the Jonesboro Sun, political columnist John Brummett, and Shay Wilson, the managing editor of the El Dorado News-Times. Roby Brock of Talk Business will moderate the debate. It will be streamed live at Fox16.com Friday, beginning at noon. Excerpts from the debate will also be heard throughout next week on Ozarks at Large. And again, if you have a suggestion for a question for Friday's debate between John Bozeman and Blanche Lincoln, just click on my name below my picture at our website, ozarksatlarge.com.
On Talk of the Nation, we tackle the day's issues and discuss the topics that matter to you. We take the time to explore every angle of the story, and we do it all live with your help. Find out what everyone's talking about. I'm Jennifer Ludden. Tune in and join the conversation next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation every weekday afternoon from 1 until 3 on KUAF 91.3 FM, right after the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. Almost 90 years ago, a daring, though unsuccessful and ultimately fatal, bank robbery took place in the heart of Eureka Springs. It's believed to have been the first such caper to use an automobile as the escape plan. For decades, the village has commemorated the heist in an unusual way. And, as Ozarks at Large's Ithi Agnihotri-Modolker reports, the city will mark the anniversary again this weekend.
Claimed by many to be the first bank robbery in the United States in which a car was used as a getaway vehicle, the 1922 Eureka Springs bank robbery will be reenacted on September 11th. The bank robbery, according to Jeff Feldman, president and CEO of the Greater Eureka Springs Chamber of Commerce, was an ill-conceived attempt by a gang of robbers from Oklahoma that was foiled by the townspeople.
A gang reportedly from Oklahoma thought they would make a large score by robbing the bank just after the payroll had been received by the bank. And they had cased the bank on numerous occasions and decided that 12 high noon, was a good time to rob the bank, as everyone except perhaps one teller went home for lunch.
Unfortunately, the robber appointed to keep track of time set his watch an hour early. Consequently, the robbers reached the bank at 11 a.m. instead of high noon as originally planned.
Instead of robbing the bank at high noon, they attempted to rob the bank about 11 a.m., about an hour before lunch. And the bank was equipped with a foot pedal alarm at the time, according to news reports. The teller had the wherewithal to hit the foot pedal alarm, which alerted numerous businesses adjacent and near the bank. And apparently at that time, many of the townsfolk during that time period were wont to wear guns and weapons. So they came out, realized what was happening at the bank, and as the robbers made their exit, the townsfolk drew down on them and shot several of the robbers. According to news reports, they winged the getaway kick car driver, who later crashed into some buildings or an iron post during his getaway, and he was also captured. So I think there were a couple of fatalities and one or two survivors. The one and only Eureka Springs failed bank robbery.
The 1922 Eureka Springs bank robbery is in its 40th year of reenactment and will be preceded by the antique car parade that will feature between 250 and 400 antique automobiles. The automobiles will also be judged, and awards and cash prizes will be handed out to the winners. Held typically the weekend after the Labor Day weekend, the reenactment will begin as soon as the cars line up at a nearby shopping village or downtown Eureka Springs.
During the time of the parade, we have some bandits and some floozies, some town folks that are dressed up. that hobnob with the crowd. Usually the streets are lined with throngs and thousands of people anticipating the parade and the bank robbery.
The lead car of the parade, which is typically used as the getaway car for the reenactment, will then be led to the site of the original bank robbery in downtown Eureka Springs. This year, a 1934 Ford Model A will be used as the lead car, even though it was a 1922 Ford Model T that was used as the getaway vehicle in the original robbery. Before the reenactment starts, a group of troubadours will situate themselves in a balcony overlooking the old bank and narrate the failed 1922 bank robbery in songs.
Pretty close to high noon, the robbers and the getaway car converge on the store that used to house the bank, and the bad guys enter the bank and come out. And we use blank ammunition in real guns. This is a troop that's been performing for a very, very, very long time, a troop of locals, as is our floozies and other folks. And they proceed to have a shootout in the middle of the street where most of the bad guys are killed. And our heroes, our town folks, are celebrated. But it can get pretty loud and pretty smoky in the middle of the street there. It's fairly authentic and definitely raises some eyebrows and grabs your attention if you're not prepared for it. So it's a lot of fun.
But that is not all. There is more fun to be had.
Then we have a little fun with the undertakers who come out and kind of measure our bad guys for coffins. And everybody just has a grand old time during the reenactment. It's an opportunity for a lot of photos. We usually get the bad guys and the floozies and the good guys together for a group shot before everything happens, so it's a lot of fun.
The 1922 Eureka Springs Bank robbery reenactment will begin close to high noon on September 11th at the original location of the First National Bank of Eureka Springs, where now the store Rock and Mineral Mine stands. For more details on participation in the Antique Car Parade or the reenactment, please visit www.eurekaspringschamber.com. For Results at Large, this is Iti Agniotri Mudholkar.
And next on Ozarks at Large, wildlife essayist Joe Neal tells us about the nervous pleasure of embracing a very rare swan.
What you just heard was a big flock of sandhill cranes. Small numbers of sandhills occur in Arkansas every year during migration in winter. But you can see thousands of them during migration through central Oklahoma. There is power in these flocks. It reminds us of the old days when they ruled the prairies. I got to thinking about big birds because there's an even bigger one, the trumpeter swan, that once occurred regularly in Arkansas. Trumpeters have become extremely rare. Not as rare as ivory-billed woodpeckers, but trumpeters are now making an obvious comeback. If you've been over to the Buffalo National River this summer, you may have seen two or three trumpeters on the old mill pond at Boxley. These birds are part of the comeback. The following recordings are a little rough because they were made back in February on a day when part of this trumpeter swan comeback in Arkansas was underway. Trumpeters were going to be released. Excited folks crowded around the cages. The swans were anxious and were hissing at the fingers of little boys who weren't supposed to poke at the caged birds. That all adds up to a bunch of static in the recordings. It was fun to experience all of the noisy to-do about a rare bird. What you've just heard were swans making threatening hisses from within cages. Doug James and I drove to Hollow Bend National Wildlife Refuge near Russellville for the release of trumpeter swans that were reared in Iowa. Curious folks are milling around trying to get a close look. I'm trying to hold my sound recorder near a cage, competing for space with two curious boys. Karen Rao of Arkansas Game and Fish has been working with Iowa Department of Natural Resources to return trumpeters to Arkansas. After a lot of hissing, the time comes to get the big birds out and walk with them to freedom on the Arkansas River. Karen rounds up volunteers, including Doug and I, to carry swans from cages to water's edge. So I am honored by a close encounter with the trumpeter. That's 25 to 30 pounds of powerful bird, ready to be free. You must first hold their feet tightly, web feet the size of my hands. You firmly hug them to keep that 8-foot wingspan closed. Then there is the famous trumpet, a long neck, with an anxious, intelligent, dark-eyed creature winding around and over your head. With a long neck, it seems serpent-like, watching all, honking and hissing, way, way ready for release. Due to efforts by folks like Karen, the Iowa DNR, and others, trumpeters are coming back. Efforts to restore wildlife populations reflect well on us humans. Of course, many things have gone intentionally and unintentionally wrong on the environmental front. Take the big BP oil spill as the most current example. We are way guilty of many screw-ups. We still cause the extinction of entire species, but we are also willing to put our amazing brains to work to put things right. In this case, we are bringing trumpeters back. 16 swans found their freedom in Arkansas that day. This is a good thing to keep in mind when you go over to the Buffalo and get a look at the swans in Boxley. It's also a good thing to remember as we tackle other necessary environmental challenges.
The trumpeter swan releases at Holoban National Wildlife Refuge near Dardanelle and on Boxley Valley Mill Pond on the Buffalo National River in western Newton County are part of a 3-year experimental program of Iowa's Department of Natural Resources and the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission. Joe Neal is author of Birds in Northwestern Arkansas, An Ecological Perspective, available at Nightbird Books in Fayetteville. He's also co-author, with Douglas James, of Arkansas Birds, published by the University of Arkansas Press. And to see a photograph of Joe and the swan, you can visit the OzarksAtLarge.com page. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, Combs, a listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. KUAF has proudly served as your source for NPR programming for the past 25 years. Remember, you can listen online at KUAF.com. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks for listening. Happy birthday, Mom.